Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on the evolving world of sports science. I'm Andrew Rizza, an athlete trainer with decades of experience in professional, collegiate, and high school sports.
And I'm Cameron Roth, an orthopedic surgeon and a consultant for the Chicago White Sox.
In each episode, we'll explore the real-world challenges and opportunities facing today's human performance professionals.
Our hands-on experience is transforming sports medicine and breaking barriers through innovation and teamwork.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. I'd like to welcome Sean Owen, sports science coordinator for the Boston Red Sox. Sean's a sports scientist with the Red Sox based out of Boston. Before moving to the United States, he worked with New Zealand's Professional Rugby Union as the sports scientist and coordinator for both the Crusaders and the Canterbury Rugby Football Union. His experience also spanned the sports and technology sector and collegiate athletics and providing sports science consulting to teams and individuals worldwide. Sean holds a bachelor's degree of science and sports science in high performance sports from Stellenbosch University in South Africa. He earned his PhD as well in sports science from the Department of Health and Medical Science in Stellenbosch. And his doctoral research focused on position-specific demands of rugby. Sean, welcome to the show. I appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. I know it's been a while of trying to coordinate, so good to get on with you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Just to give everybody a little bit of background, so a really good friend and colleague of mine, who's an athletic trainer for the Red Sox, you guys have seen on the show before, Anthony Cerundolo, works with Sean and introduced us. We had not met each other since today, but I felt it was going to be a great conversation as I have a little bit of background in applied sports science analytics, and who better to speak to a sports scientist for our famed Boston Red Sox, world champion Boston Red Sox. And before we started the conversation, I had mentioned to Sean that I had actually been in Stellenbosch, which for the first time this past summer, which was amazing. So we had a little bit of a conversation about that, which was great. Sean, give us a little bit more background from what I provided about yourself to the listeners.
Sure. So if I started with the studies, you touched on the key points there, but to go into a little bit of detail, I think some of them are slightly different to what's rolled out in the States. For undergrad, went through Bachelor of Science, which majors in sports science, where you're doing your traditional science topics, your maths, physics, chemistry, biochemistry, human and animal physiology. And then that's paired with the sports-specific topics of sports nutrition, sports psychology, obviously exercise physiology. And that'll run over a three-year course. After that, you've got the option to carry on to honors as kind of your first one-year postgrad. I chose to do high performance sports, where you start focusing on working with elite teams. On the back of that, started my master's, which after a year and a half, upgraded that to PhD. And after about a five-year journey, finally handed that in. As far as career goes, early career over there was kind of your standard while you're doing postgrad, almost interning with the department there, lecturing, running labs, working with kind of the Stellenbosch University college team and helping them there where I can. That was also predominantly rugby focused. First professional team I went with was an internship with Stormers, which I guess is essentially a state type team back in South Africa, Cape Town. And after that, was fortunate enough to get a position with the Crusaders and Canterbury Rugby over New Zealand. That was an awesome learning experience, an opportunity to do Crusaders, which is essentially the premier competition there for most of the year, and then in the off season where Canterbury, which is again like a state team. That was great because essentially it was cramming two different teams worth into a single year of a 5-year period. So got to see different ways of doing things, different coaches, working with different practitioners, and it's an awesome group over there, great culture. And while I was over there, kind of met a lot of people across Australia and New Zealand. One of them, Michael Chinchosi, who I kept in contact with. And I think it was 2018, he came over and started the sports science department with the Sox. Mm-hmm. 2-3 years later, gave me a call, asked if I wanted to come help expand the department. And then I came over as a sports scientist. 2 years after that, he headed back to Australia, working, I think, with the Australian Institute now, which is an exciting opportunity leading up to their Olympics. And then I took over the department chair.
Michael and I just spoke beginning of the week, and I think I mentioned this to you pre-recording, and he was a professor of mine when I went to get my applied sports science master's degree at LaSalle University, and he had, I think, LaSalle had tried to think of a way to try to provide the next level for their education, for their students, and especially for people like myself that's in, that are athletic trainers or even looking to expand their practice. And for me, that it just made sense to go through that and to be able to provide more for the athletes that I care for. As we see that evolving through like collegiate and professional sports over the last probably 10 years in the United States, maybe even a little less than that. But for you, you know, being in sports science and across the other parts of the world, like you said, New Zealand, Australia, that's where it really was born, right? Is that where sports science kind of got its legs and then started to grow into the US?
Yeah, I'd definitely say so. I think the Australians could probably be credited with the real birth of I guess, what's become modern sports science. I think as far as classical sports science, the things of foundational knowledge, scientific principles, like basic periodization, those things have been around for a while. And it was actually quite an eye-opener going over to the UFC. Their sports science coordinator is a Russian guy. And he was talking about universities that they've had for 150 plus years that have focused specifically on sports science. But I think we had a second resurgence what's over in Australia where they were awarded the Olympics coming up. And then early 2000s, government started funding, essentially trying to put themselves in the best spot to earn medals. And that translated into, I guess, an explosion of research and technology on the back of it. And that's probably why you're seeing all of these companies that are used in sports science coming out of Australia. Mm-hmm. So I guess they had first hands on with all of this new technology, whether it's GPS, force plates, infrared spectrometry, anything that like just allowed them to do deeper level research that we couldn't do previously, they started doing. And that kind of bled through osmosis into New Zealand, which is there, South Africa, the UK, which is closely related with sports. And once it started to take off, and I think they saw a lot of success in their Olympic programs, then it seemed to trickle over to the US. And with the resources available in the US, they can go quite deep down on those verticals. And I think they've accelerated to a point where they've caught up and are probably competing at that stage.
Yeah, I mean, we've had the evidence-based research for, I mean, we've been looking at it for 20 plus years here in the US, especially with athletic training. I mean, that's how we looked at specificity of, you know, testing and what we were doing in the athletic training profession. So it's just the next level of that now. It's like, how do we take the data, present the data, tell the story to the athlete, the coach, the stakeholder, in order to give them the information that they need to understand, like, hey, we're doing this for X, Y, and Z, and doing it research-based versus just saying, you know, do this because it's going to work. And I think, you know, that's the good thing about sports science is when I first heard about it, you know, about 8 or 10 years ago, when we started to see a break in the professional sports in the United States, especially with like the Bruins, the Red Sox coming on in 18 and seeing that, we were all kind of scratching our head like, well, what is this? What's a sports scientist? What are they doing? How are they helping us with our practice? And once we learned more about it and how it's going to benefit the athlete, it just made sense, right? And then how do you put those people in the right positions? And do you influence and try to educate the other healthcare professionals to get that team to work together for the best interest of who you're working for? And it sounds like you guys are doing that well before we were doing it here, right? And then how do we make it better in this part of the country or world, really, to make it more beneficial?
Yeah, it's really interesting because it's a topic that often comes up where it bleeds so heavily into different kind of industries and disciplines. And there's the foundational knowledge where there's your basic sciences, which is there, and you've kind of dipped your toes in the other areas. But by no means would we classify a sports scientist as, say, a medical practitioner or a true SMC. But as the evolution of sports science continues, a lot of the areas that they're focusing on and those scientific principles apply across the board. They apply it to medical. Like you say, medical's probably always done it. It's just going through a different lens now. S&C have been periodizing, like I said, right back in the Soviet regime, to some of like Charlie Francis's work, to all the more modern techniques now. The difference is probably the technological aspect that put it on the map, where now there's some data that's coming back. You're getting some feedback on what you're doing, and using that, you can essentially either review, do your own research, kind of do it on a global scale if you're doing it across a league, and hopefully push the industry forward. But a lot of the things that were classified as sports science a few years ago, or 5-10 years ago, are now owned by the other disciplines.
How do you fit, really? We talked, I mean, just for a second on medical team. How does a sports scientist fit into that role? Like how you work with the medical team? What does your day look like? Do you have an influence on injury, you know, helping with injury report? Do you have an influence on looking at ways to prevent the injury? Or are you strictly just looking at performance related, you know, metric with athletes?
So it's evolved a little bit, and my role specifically might not necessarily represent all of sports science, because there's what most would term an embedded sports scientist who is living, working with the team, really part of that tight-knit unit. And then there's more of the R&D type sports scientist. And within those two as well, you've got your generalists and your specialists are going deep down verticals. So if we're looking at, I guess, where I'd see myself and where I've fit in the past, as far as the day-to-day piece of the medical, on the one side, the R&D side, it'll be trying to provide solutions to any of the kind of complex questions that are there that we haven't answered yet, be that going and finding technology that we think is valid, reliable, testing that, make sure it can hopefully attend to provide a solution to that problem, or day-to-day, the traditional work, traditional kind of responsibilities of sports science has been workload management, testing and monitoring. So if we're talking rugby, for example, a day in the life might be get there 7 a.m, 7:15, you have your tight medical meeting. On the sports science side, you'd be highlighting players that are, I don't necessarily want to say at risk, but have gone outside of zones that we have set, mm-hmm. be that workload related, haven't hit mark sprints we want them to do. They've got a culmination of metrics that have started to drop off, anything like that, any flag for whatever reason is brought up and discussed in a holistic setting. Because as always, we need context, I think, with all of this information. Once the medical meeting would be finished, coaches would come in and you'd have more of a global meeting planned for the day. How are we going to change practice? Do we need to change practice? From there, break, you'll have kind of standard player meetings where we can prep for the day. We would normally have a gym session at some stage, and we'd always push for as close as you can get to this invisible type monitoring. So work things into the gym sessions. Part of their lift is jumping with a velocity tracker or on the plates, running the accelerations in the gym and getting times on them. So any kind of testing that we can use as part of their training session, but get feedback on. Once that finishes up, we'd start prepping for field session. So set up GPS outside. We'd normally have a big kind of 42-inch TV that we'd leave on the sideline. From there, we have the plan from the morning. So as players go out and they're in training, have a mic on, be linked up to the head of performance there, coaches, and start to just give updates on where the training is at the stage. Are we hitting the intensity we want to? Are we hitting the volumes that we need? Do we need to pull back, continue training for 15, 20 minutes? We'll probably go through most of the training like that. And then on the sideline, you've got your individuals returning from play. They'll have specific targets to hit. And then top-ups at the end of session. So once the group's kind of hit exactly where you want them to be, what are we prescribing for those who potentially didn't get into full training? Mm-hmm. After that, coming off the field, kind of team review, session review, plan for the next day, and carry on. So that's probably closer to an embedded sports scientist. If you split it down into R&D, then your time kind of is a little bit split where you're trying to lock yourself away and get to work deep down on a project, manage potential university relationships, external, internal research, and essentially take a project through its full life cycle from idea conception, you've got this problem, to doing a full lit review, what's out there, speaking to industry experts, what's the best solution, getting that solution in, running a pilot study, seeing if it's doing what we want it to do, and then judging the results, reviewing it, and pushing forward and scaling that up if it is something that we want to implement.
That's a fantastic explanation. And I think for the listeners, just to give them a little bit more clarity, for training, they would be, you know, either GPS tracked, wearables, Oura Ring, Whoop, whatever that may be, to make sure that they're performing at the level you would like them within the thresholds. And the thresholds could be as simple as you have red for your above threshold, yellow, you're, you know, in the between, and green, you're actually perfectly fine, to one, look at performance related metrics, and then maybe, you know, looking more along the lines of, hey, if we're trying to simulate game situations in training to get them to performance levels, we need to be able to make sure that we're watching them as far as injury prevention. So if that's correct, I think that's what you were trying to describe during the day in the life is during the performance section.
Yeah, that's exactly it. For me, we got more and more data coming in all the time, but there's that foundational layer, and you touched on it there. It's, if we're talking field-based work, GPS is essentially going to give you part of that, and heart rate. And with that, I like to split it up into kind of a internal-external load, mechanical demand on the body, and how the body is responding to that load. I've always broken it up into four pillars there, where you're essentially getting some sort of volume metric. How much are you actually getting, like, through the calves, through the lower limbs? And this is obviously sport dependent, but in rugby, that it's one of the bigger ones. Soccer's similar. So volume metric, some sort of acceleration metric, so a descriptor of that volume, that heart rate internal response, which is normally some form of a trimp. And lastly, just high speed exposure.
How much do you end up looking at? Well, two things. One, heart rate variability with an athlete to see whether or not they're performing at their level. If that's a metric you can grab out of what you're using for a tool, but also sleep performance, because sleep's a big one. If they're not getting the sleep, they're not recovering, they're not performing, and then they have a higher rate of injury. Do you guys end up looking, as a sports scientist, do you look at that?
That's something I do look at. It's quite well established in, I think, endurance-based sports, where you've seen a number of papers now using traditional periodization versus HRV-based adaptive periodization. And a lot of the time that HRV-based periodization outperforms traditional periodization. It is quite unique to endurance because you are doing these long, you know, you're going to be on the bike for 3 hours, or you might be in the pool, whatever it is. But I do think that there's crossover there. And I am a fan of heart rate variability, where I think it provides a holistic picture to how the body is responding. What you do with it is probably the challenge. Sometimes we want to see a significant flag there if we are going through, say, an overreaching block. But I do think it does give that kind of tell-all, everything going in, how is the body coping with this? It's a bit of a double-edged sword in that way, where you don't necessarily know what's causing it, but you do have that output. And what ties them so closely with that is sleep. I think that's one of the things that isn't even up for debate anymore. It is such a foundational piece, but it's also one of the pieces that are, I guess, less sexy, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
Where athletes, you look at recovery, they want to go do something that feels hard, say, get in a nice bath, they feel like they've recovered, do something that's really making them feel like they've put the work in to accelerate their recovery, where 9 times out of 10, an extra hour of sleep is going to outperform any of that. So as a field, we probably still in a phase where we need to get the technology right to accurately measure sleep as far as sleep staging. But I do think we can get valuable information out of resting heart rate overnight, your heart rate variability, your time in bed, and even those we can use to build habits. One of the main reasons I do like to record it is it's been a bit of a light bulb moment for a lot of athletes I've worked with in the past, where, say, take alcohol, for example. You tell them, we're wanting to maximize recovery, we've got a short turnaround before another game, let's stay away from any drinks post-game, and that's it. But with a wearable and, say, overnight HRV, you can instantly see, you have one drink, two drinks, three drinks, and you might see a 30% reduction in HRV, which that becomes that light bulb moment where all of a sudden it becomes very real. This is my body's ability to recover. We're seeing it be significantly taxed from whatever habit it is that we have that we're looking at and trying to educate on. And we have seen a lot of buy-in on the back of that.
Yeah, the other piece to that, I think, is, you know, we look at sleep. There's a study that just came out, and I don't have it in front of me, but I know that one of the head performance leads for Whoop, she's the global head of that department, Kristen Holmes, was talking about how melatonin plays a huge role with circadian rhythms. Has there been any discussion on what type of supplement outside for an athlete that might be struggling to get the sleep, if that's been discussed, or is that something that that has been used, you know, within any athlete that you've worked with, but also what goes into their body, like you said, alcohol, what's the nutritional values of, that they're doing every day? What are they pulling into their body versus what helps them perform? How do you measure nutritional value? Like, that's pretty tough unless somebody's telling you, like, there's not a way for us to put something on their body and say, hey, you've taken in this much protein, this much carbohydrate, this much fat, this micro versus macronutrient. I think in professional sports, is probably easy, probably nutritionists that are actually going through that with the athletes individually. What's the conversation look like for you as a sports scientist to say, hey, look at this study, look at this data. We talked about the R&D a little bit. How does that play into that? And then all the other stuff you're trying to do.
Yeah, we're fairly fortunate where the team, most professional teams would be well-resourced in that regard, where there's definitely an in-house dietitian. There's mental performance coaches that are upskilled in sleep. In certain cases, you'll have a sleep doctor as a consultant for cases that are quite significant. Going back to the first question there, as far as melatonin and any supplements, my foundational layer would always be habits. Like, have we got the right habits? And all your classic ones of, let's have a dark room, let's have it cold, let's cut screen time before going to bed. That would be your best case, ideal scenario before touching anything else. I think in professional sports, it can be challenging, especially baseball. Like, if you're looking at sports like rugby, soccer, AFL, you're only playing once in a while and you're going to expect to have a hard time sleeping after that. But baseball, you're playing almost every single game all day. And when you're not playing, you're traveling, and that's normally overnight.
Right, right.
So sleep is a definite challenge there. As far as the conversations with athletes themselves, I think anything that can show them a hard number of what's happening, and this goes for all things, performance correlations, anything that we really believe in, if we can show it on an individual level for that person, it becomes quite valuable and strong in telling that story. Something that I've always liked as far as trying to get buy-in in those regards, whether it's anything in that realm, like throwing on a Whoop or a continuous glucose monitoring, any of those things that we don't want to do necessarily all the time, or an athlete doesn't want to do all the time, is having short stints of education packages, if you want to call it that. Someone's having an issue sleeping. Let's put this on for 6 weeks. First 2 weeks, I want you to do nothing. Next week, I want you to change this habit and track and see how that happens, or see what happens, how your body responds. And I think they find a lot of value in that. If there's no change, okay, let's try the next step, the next tool, the next tool, the next tool. On the melatonin front, I go back to the habits with that, where if we're looking to break a cycle, say you've done international travel and you know you're not going to sleep tonight, and it's not because of your poor habits, it's because you've just done a time zone shift of 12 hours, then I think there's value in like a 1-3 day use of it to get you back into that routine. As a once-off once in a while, I think it's good. I don't like the idea of having it as a crutch to get to sleep. Mm-hmm. You don't follow those foundational habits and you use it to try to get to sleep. I don't think that's necessarily sustainable long-term.
Yeah, I'd have to agree on that. If you haven't seen the study, I'll shoot it over to you after. I got to dive a little bit more into it and see what their population, who they were, and what they truly were looking at in the study. I feel like with anything else they were doing in our profession, we do a lot of assessing of our athletes, and there's tools that we use to come to a proper assessment. So for instance, like if we see someone that comes in that thinks they've had a head injury, we'll evaluate them, and we have certain tools we use to assess and confirm or deny the injury. We use that tool to give us the data that we need to be able to back up our objective findings. But I think one of the things that we have to rely on the most is understanding who the athlete is and knowing the athlete. And that gives us the best indicator, yes or no, if something's going on with them. And we talk a lot with physicians and colleagues about this. And I feel like you're kind of in the same boat where, you know, you talked about devices and uses. I would think that you're relying a lot on your understanding of who that athlete is to see if they actually are performing to the level they're performing at, and using the data to present to the stakeholders that maybe don't know the athlete as well to understand, like, hey, how are we going to get them to where they need to be? So for instance, if you had, we just simply take sleep in international travel or sleep cross country, you may see somebody, if they're able to wear the device and monitor them and they're showing up at a threshold, but their performance is still where it needs to be, that person just could be showing data that may not be specific enough for them as the athlete versus somebody that could be in the yellow and doesn't perform as well with their sleep. So I think it really probably comes down to knowing the athlete more than not and using the tool to help provide information if you're not getting what you need.
Yeah, I think that's bang on. And that's kind of where the industry is gone now. If you look at, so I'm not sure if you're familiar with Martin Boucher, but he's, I guess, relatively famous in the sports science circles and released an article recently about the evolution of sports science and, mm-hmm. and how it's gone. And he kind of termed it sports science 1.0, which is what we were talking about earlier, like all of the foundational type research that's been going on for years in different disciplines. And it was sports science just carried by each discipline. Then it went to that sports science 2.0 is what he terms it, where we had the technological boom, and all of a sudden you have all of this data coming in without too much research behind it because it's all so new. And that's where I think there's potentially teams that went down somewhat of a dangerous path there, where you aren't focusing on the individual, you're hyper-fixating on metrics, and metrics that only tell a very small piece of a bigger picture. And I think where we're getting to now with the development of more technology, but also more robust software to bring it all together, is moving from that kind of sports science 2.0, where there's all the classic stories of like GPS has come out, you got soccer at the highest level, and have a sports scientist sitting there saying, he's hit his threshold, he needs to come off the field now. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at volume and high intensity running. Meanwhile, the player's having the game of his life. He's like the glue in the team. His running is so contextual. Maybe it's over because of the pattern that they're playing or the opposition that we're playing against. There's times where they say he's not running enough, but maybe it's because he's just a smart player and he's in the right position at the right time. So I think we're starting to move away from that as a field, where we got this tool, and I guess you got this, all you've got is a hammer and everything looks like a nail, and you're just making these same kind of decisions based on this one singular metric, where it eventually takes us to that sports science 3.0, which I think we're hitting now, where we're really starting to have valuable impact. But the result of that is almost pulling back our recommendations in a way, where we're going from this kind of data-driven, evidence-based, whichever way they like to term it, to more of a data-informed, mm-hmm. where we have this, but we realize it's only accounting for 50% of what we're trying to do. The other 50% needs to be a contextual kind of collaboration across all the stakeholders and the different departments. And that's probably going to put us in the best position for that one single individual.
Yeah, I mean, I agree 100%. I think, you know, it's understanding the behaviors, changing the behaviors, and using the tools to be able to help you to get to that spot, right? So as I alluded to earlier, concussion, we would, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, we were dealing with it different than we do today. We were always, you know, hyper-focused on the metrics. And if we had someone come in the metrics were off the board, like they were off the chart, we're like, no, we can't exercise you. We can't do anything with you. And then it's, you know, turned 180 degrees now, where if somebody comes in and their metrics aren't fantastic, but they're reporting less symptoms, we want to exercise them to keep them active, because what's happening is we're seeing a decline in their function because anxiety, depression sets in because they're not being active. So you have to know the athlete. I mean, just our practice has changed, you know, tremendously from the R&D side of it, what we're seeing with our athletes, how we know our athletes. And it's the same thing with the sports science, where, like you had said, we were looking at the metric, we were looking at the data, and we were really hyper-focused on the data. And that athlete may be a threshold, but they're saying, hey, I feel awesome. Like, I'm having the game of my life. Like, what are you doing pulling me off the field? And I think that's the important piece, is to understand your athlete, talk to the stakeholders, let them understand, like, hey, this is something we're going to use to monitor, but it may not be 100% of what we want to be able to do with the athlete if they're performing in a way that we see is normal for them, which is an important piece.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head there, where it's what you're doing maybe 5-10 years ago could be a full 180. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to have the right personality of people in place, where ego is put aside and we just make the best decisions we can at the time with information that we have. And 10 years ago, that might be what we thought was the answer. Mm-hmm. And I think being brave and in a way that allows us to explore different fields and explore different things and push the boundaries is important to move the industry forward. But being able to do exactly that And I guess that becomes a scientific principle in itself, where we've tried this method, it was the best option at the time. Now we actually know there's a better method, we should move towards that. And that's how we continually develop.
Yeah, we talk about innovation all the time, and innovation is key. If you're not innovating, you're not improving yourself as a professional, but you're also not doing justice to the people you're caring for. So you have to be very innovative and use the things that are available to you to make the best decisions that are for the person you're caring for. And I always say, it's not about you, it's about the people you're caring for. So
absolutely.
It's not about you. Yeah. Even though a lot of people think it is, you know, it is true. Where do you think, and talk about innovation, I mean, AI scares a lot of people, but I think it can be used in the way that is better for what we're doing daily, for whatever reason you want to use it. Where do you think that's going to fit? Or do you feel like that's the next level of what we do in our profession, whether it be sports medicine, sports science, caring for athletes? Where do you think AI is going to fit? And do you think it's going to be something that's going to help you do a better job every day?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think there's aspects of AI that are certainly overhyped, and you've seen it in kind of VCs and all the different startups that have skyrocketed, gotten huge funding, and then not necessarily been successful. But I think that there's huge value at the same time. Something that's already of huge value is just efficiency. And I think if you look at AI on scale, what it allows us to do is essentially take a decision tree and apply it to mass data in a very short amount of time. So I think we can handle more data, we can do more with it, as well as our day-to-day processes, automation, anything that'll take us an hour a couple of years ago is probably going to take us 2 minutes going forward. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So freeing up time to focus on the things that matter. But I think as it evolves and it gets better, it's going to be a crucial part of that sports science 3.0, where if you look at different hot topics in sports science at the moment, one of them being biomechanical tracking.
Yes.
You're getting huge, huge amounts of data flowing in that would be very hard to, or very tedious to work through and look for specific flags, be it of fatigue, of performance, not only in itself, but in combination with a holistic kind of data set of different metrics. So start folding in strength scores, how you're performing aerobically, if you got muscle oxygen saturation, you got your HRV, all of these different ones with biomechanical data to try and give you one kind of ultimate recommendation, which I don't think we're at that place yet, but I think it's going to start to accelerate us towards the answer there.
I mean, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to, you know, mention biomechanical analysis and then machine learning. I mean, because think of the stuff that's available. I mean, look behind me, you can see that picture of that's Carl Yastrzemski back in 67. So I'm sure there's a few of those pictures floating around the ballpark. But you think about machine learning and how you can utilize that to be able to capture what you need to with your professional athletes or collegiate or high school athletes. And then also, how do you take that information and dissect it? We can only do so much, but if there's a certain position in an arm slot where somebody's throwing that you're not picking up with the eye and you're not seeing it on what you can see with your motion capture, but that machine learning could pick it up like that, then that's something that could be just a critical piece for you to be able to look at, to be able to take to that athlete and say, hey, listen, there's something with your lower extremity that we're seeing that we didn't pick up before, or something with your trunk rotation, your hip rotation that we didn't see before, that's making you drop your arm, you know, 30 pitches into a session, you know, whatever it may be. But it can, you know, hopefully advance in a way that we can see that and then use that tool, right? And then make sure that we're doing the right thing for the athlete so they can be at the highest performance level that they need to be at.
100%. It takes me back to college, where you're in our biomechanics course. I'm not sure if the company's still around, but Dartfish was something that we'd have. And you literally have a video and you're manually tagging where the different relevant points are. You're getting your angles. And back then they were starting to look at things like this, but it would probably take you a couple of days to
to map it, right?
Yeah. So now we have markerless cameras that's going to pick it up.
Yeah, they're amazing. Like when I was doing my master's, we had a course in the program that we had to do machine learning. And then I did mine on pitch mechanics. And literally I stood up in the office that I'm in now in my house, and I took myself and then took like three or four just mechanical, biomechanical throws or pitch, and it picked it up. Like, it was amazing. It was like just the camera on my computer. And I'm like, yeah, back in the day, we would have had to mark everything and map it out, and the distance had to be correct. And now it just completely does it for you, where it's amazing that you can actually have that technology advancement.
Yeah, it really is. And it opens up so many doors. Like biomechanics is in the spotlight now, but you're essentially working with machine learning and computer vision.
Yeah.
And those two hand in hand have kind of an untapped amount of opportunity in the field, whether it's from scouting applications to a list of projects that we got in the background at the moment that we're working through. But it really opens up doors for things that are like foundationally and knowledge-wise, we know there's backed research there, but we haven't had the systems and that efficiency to implement them. Mm-hmm. And for myself personally, anything that I'm looking to implement, it needs to probably one of three things. It either needs to provide information that we're not getting yet that's valuable to one of those complex problems, or take a current process, make it more accurate and reliable, or it needs to make it more efficient. So between computer vision and machine learning, you could take a lot of processes that are currently happening, make them more objective, potentially more accurate, and definitely more efficient. So I think there's a plethora of opportunity that'll come with that.
If there was one tool that you only had available to you as a sports scientist to make your day easier or to provide information to the people you're working with, what would that be?
That's a tough one because there's such an umbrella. But I think if you're talking new team, they haven't got much set up, it essentially becomes that data pipeline where if you haven't got somewhere to collect data, store data, manipulate it, and then visualize or feedback reports, that's the backbone of what Red needs. So again, it's not that sexy, but it's a foundational piece that would have to be in place. And it doesn't need to be high end for that level either. You between Excel, Google Sheets, any of these kind of free resources that are out there, almost free, you can put together some very comprehensive systems.
If there's somebody that does not have the funding and wants to provide some type of data or something, like you said, foundational to make the stakeholders understand like how you're going to provide increased performance and potentially reduce the chance of overuse injury, what is something they could have available to them? Would it be something like a Google Sheets or Excel spreadsheet that they can provide information, or is there something else out there that they can use that is more, I guess, sexy, right? Something that gives them a little bit more than numbers. You know, I think you could turn Google into, or even Excel into a storybook, right? So you can definitely use it that way. But if somebody doesn't have that background or doesn't understand, what is something that you think they could use that would help them?
So for me, it would probably be getting a dedicated person in there. And I know resources are probably scarce. So, so even if it's an associate level, like there's people coming out of college at all different levels looking for experience, whether it be in a practice with a sports team, any of those, just to I guess get their feet wet. They normally come out with so much energy and they want to sink into building these kind of things. So I normally go there's a bunch of technology, but I'm always people before technology. So if there's any funding whatsoever, even if it's on a low level, or even if it's giving them like clothing and just making them feel part of a team and experience, it would be getting someone in there that can do it. And then they probably would hopefully come with that skill set where, say, it's between Excel and Power BI.
Yeah.
Both are basically free. And there's still some professional teams and NFL, NHL, and Major League that rely on those two systems. So it's essentially how much time you invest in it. And as far as providing value to stakeholders, I guess it depends on the stakeholder that you're talking to. I think the immediate staff that are there will hopefully see value in reports that are produced, flags, things that they're not necessarily seeing with the eye, like you mentioned earlier. And again, if they resource scarce, you don't necessarily need a whole lot of technology. Something like RPE has been shown to perform on a lot of our workload measures at a similar level quite often. And again, that can be captured through a Google form if you wanted to, or some other clipboard.
Yeah.
But there's that aspect of kind of putting a system together, helping to give insights that aren't necessarily there at face value. But then there's also kind of the R&D side of things, where if we were looking at something that takes time of the practitioners that are already there. So say we're talking soccer, and a lot of the research has looked at groin strength, adduction, abduction ratios, relative to body weight, and the general thought there and across a lot of, I guess, the lower body muscles and injury is that in general, if you're weaker, particularly relative to body weight and relative to the population that you're with, you are on a higher likelihood of injury. Mm-hmm. So being able to take a process like that, and in our example, say you've got 200 athletes at your, if you're at a school, you might have something similar, and take all of your baseline testing, look over it, do somewhat of an internal research study, see if the injuries, you probably wouldn't have enough power to like truly link this to injury, but is it passing the sniff test as far as we're doing this test? It's either capturing or not capturing a large group of the injuries that we're expecting it to. If it's not, should we still be doing this? If it is, then you move on to the next level, which is we're doing this intervention. Are we seeing the metric that we expected to increase? So I guess essentially it comes back to having a person there to drive all of this. Mm-hmm. And at the resource scarce level, it often comes to internships and associates.
Yeah, I think you kind of said it best. I think the easiest thing is, and it's easy to grab, is RPE, and you could throw sleep in, right? And then how do you look at that over time and see? So you could take RPE, sleep, take this one soccer team and follow them, pick where the injuries happen. So if an injury happens and that person's sleep was 5 hours last night and their RPE felt like they were at an 8, like try to track that and see what happens and see how we can predict what injury is going to look like. So it's pretty simple to have them fill it out on their own and just do a, you know, like a Likert scale for them and have it so it's simple, right?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the professional rugby teams I worked with, we still put a laptop up there in the gym. Lots of colleges did it at the time. Have Excel with kind of basic VBA code where you come in, there's a sliding scale, select your name from a dropdown. How are you feeling physically? How are you feeling mentally? How was your sleep?
Yep.
Do that, carry on. And yep. Just from that, like you say, the interrelation between those 3 points as well as each one in isolation provides a lot of value.
Yeah. And if it's a practice day, hey, how can you modify practice today to make sure that we don't set you up for failure for tomorrow's contest, right? So I think there's some validity there. I think it'll be an interesting study to do to kind of see how that works out, you know, even male to female soccer teams, or, you know, if you have a track team that's in the same season, how does that look, you know? Because I think the average, and I could be wrong with this, I think the average soccer player at a level of high school and above probably runs 7 to 9 miles in a contest if they're playing, you know, 80 or 90 minutes, depending on what they're playing. So it's a lot of activity if you think of them playing 5 days a week between practice and games. So how do you measure that and show it to, again, the stakeholders to say, hey, where can we modify here to reduce, one, injury during the week in practice, but have the performance level high enough for games that you're getting the most out of your athletes?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's two layers to that, or two levels, where there's the day-to-day. I think any of that is a flag for conversation, where a conversation that might not have been had. So on the day-to-day, you can go in and look, you flagged this, and there's a conversation around what happened and an action on the back end of it. Mm-hmm. What do we do? And I think those, the number of changes there, you can certainly pass on stakeholders. I mean, I think there's a second layer of zooming out and how athletes trending. So as we go through a season, like say they're playing multiple games where they're running 7 to 9 miles, throwing training there, and you can quite quickly pick up deviations from their norm. Are they trending into a negative spot? And take action in that regard to try and get them back on track. And all of those become quite powerful messages to sell, because it's no longer just my opinion of this guy's dropping. This is a somewhat objective data, even though subjectively captured, but mm-hmm. directly from the athlete, we've been able to intervene. He's back on track. He'll play hopefully the rest of the season.
Yeah. And I think it becomes harder with high school athletics because you've got to deal with, well, even collegiate too, you're dealing with a full day of cognitive function as a student. And then you have to throw in, okay, what are the nutritional values look like during the day? Are they eating breakfast, lunch, dinner? Are they hydrating enough during the day? Then you throw a practice or a game late in the afternoon. And then when they go to bed after they do homework, like, what does that look like? So it's definitely more daunting. And then on top of that, you have some athletes that are playing in a club sport too, on top of their regular high school season, which is, to me, is, I don't know how they do it. It's completely bananas. So if you fast forward and jump to a professional level athlete, they have training, you know, they're there, they're training a bunch of times during the day, and then they have travel and they have, you know, contests, but cognitively they can kind of check out and they're not learning. I mean, they're learning probably physically how to get better, but they're not in the classroom learning. So I think you could pull that piece away from it.
Yeah, it's definitely a massive cognitive load that goes with that. And like you said, at the professional level, you have a lot of things given to you on a plateau. You have a buffet of food at any time you want it. You've got everything given, your transport, your accommodation, most of that sorted. You're not worrying about too much. You're freeing up the mind to actually play. The one thing I do like about RP that starts to fold into that is it's similar to HRV in the way that it's somewhat of a catch-all metric. Mm-hmm. So the nice thing is you could apply RPE to professional level as well as kind of that collegiate or school level, and it becomes relative to that individual.
Yep.
So I do think there's some power in that, where they definitely have these different stresses that are feeding into it, but at least those stresses are consistent for them.
Yeah, yeah. And you hope that they're, if you're doing something with RPE, that they are being truthful on how their RPE is. So they know that, what's the outcome of me providing this number day to day, right? Physically, mentally, and in the sleep piece, if we're putting that in there. But, and is that them understanding why we're doing it? To one, we want to increase your performance, like let them understand that, and to make sure that we can keep them out of our office when they get injured. So I think that's an important piece.
You said it there. It's essentially creating buy-in through education. And
yep.
And I think if they know what we're going to do with the data and it's there to support them, because essentially professional sport, college, different development levels are slightly different, but we are most of the time wanting to win. We're trying to keep the athletes healthy, and that normally goes in tandem. If they're not going to be on the field due to injury, it's probably going to cost us performance-wise. So I think as long as they understand it's in their best interest, both for their performance and health, then there's some buy-in that comes with it.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. To close out today, again, thank you for coming in and doing this conversation with me. I think it's a very valuable one, and I think we've kind of talked a lot about what our peers and also listeners that are looking into what sports science is or want to get into a career of sports science can listen to and understand a little bit more about it. If somebody wants to learn a little bit more about it, what would you suggest to them on trying to find more information about sports science or how to link it into their career? How would you steer them?
If it's early career, like pre-studies, I think studies become a prerequisite now, where there are courses available, and if you're applying for a sports science specific role, it's probably going to require that. My current suggestion with the way the field's going would be go through that foundational knowledge, where you're learning the anatomy, you're learning all the sciences, the rigors that come with science. And then masters is where you can probably branch out a bit, whether it wants to focus entirely on elite sport, bring in an analytics kind of type knowledge base is pretty strong at the moment. And then outside of the studies and that prerequisite, I think it's differentiating yourself with experience. So wherever you can get experience in terms of internships, working as an associate, it's very useful to get a foot in the door, but also to learn what it's like. And the other thing that I've found extremely valuable is having good mentors. I think that's an underutilized way of expanding knowledge, where essentially now with the internet, I think you can get access to almost anything you want to learn. The only thing it takes is discipline, and where you could invest a huge amount into a course, you could probably pay a mentor over a 6-month period, meet once a month, keeps you on track, and you just need to put the time in to learn. In general, for those that are already in established careers, as a starting point, I would say NSCA has put together a book specifically on sports science that gives kind of a surface level overview from a lot of highly regarded authors, and it touches on a bunch of different chapters. Mm-hmm. Australia's got a similar kind of setup over there. So I'd probably start with one of those two institutions and see what verticals really jump out to you before going down them.
Yeah, I think that's great. That's great information for the listener and for anybody that's looking to either start a career or add to their career like I had done. My goal was to try to provide myself with more information, more research-based understanding of sports science, so I can help the athletes that I'm dealing with and also the patients that I see that are recovering from injury. And you said it best, like mentorship is huge. We talk about this all the time. Mentorship is never wasted. It's something you always use. I still have mentors that I go to weekly for things. And even peers that I work with on a daily basis. So I think that's an important piece to try to make sure that you're staying on top of your profession. And then also, you know, doing the best for, we said it before, like, it's about the patient or the athlete. It's not about you. So trying to be better at what you do is important.
Yeah, absolutely. Player-centric before all else.
So what do you do outside of, what's your, like, enjoyment outside of looking at data and numbers and being buried in a computer? What's your fun go-to?
Outside of that, I've always enjoyed sport, probably not surprisingly. used to play, well, I grew up on rugby, but switched over to Aussie rules when I was in New Zealand and quite enjoyed that. Looking to get back into that in Boston. I know there's a local Australian kind of group and team that plays here. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, recently got into rock climbing and I'm thoroughly enjoying that. My fiance and I have a gym just up the road. I think it's a 2-minute walk. So
that's great.
That's the current challenge at the moment.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, you got to get out and do other things besides what you are buried in week over week.
In this phase, we shift more towards that R&D layer. So we have projects in preparation for next year, but it's certainly not as intense as the heart of season.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I appreciate the time that you put into today, and I hope we can keep this conversation going and you know, bounce things off each other down the road.
Awesome. Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate you having me.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Follow us on social media and check out our website.
The information shared on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Please consult a licensed healthcare provider for guidance related to your specific situation. We'll see you next week.